You may recall I gave you that Blake poem and I read it out in the lecture on Laplanche's theory. It's a very powerful but itself very puzzling symbolic allegory, The Mental Traveller, which begins with the birth of a child. If the child is born a boy, he's given to a woman old. She nails him down upon a rock and catches his shrieks in cups of gold. And a whole cycle is followed through. He turns into a bleeding youth. She turns into a maiden or a virgin bright. He binds her down in a repetition of the way in which he has been bound down. And the poem traces this cycle through a whole allegorical series of transformations until it comes full circle and it ends restating that same situation. Now you've got there an image of the impact, and a rather violent one. It's elaborated in a later stanza as she implants herself in all his nerves, Blake says. So we've got there a powerful and indeed an extreme image of the adult's impact on. Indeed, he uses the same metaphor, I think, of implanting that Laplanche does in the infant and the infant's body. And we've got our example from Little Hands of the mother trying not to be intrusive, invasive, possessive, as it were, but nevertheless, as it were, marking the child's body in her very abstention, okay, as she thinks from intruding on what might be a sensitive part of his body. Now, there's also an image in Sophocles' play, Oedipus, that one could put with those two images. Now, Sophocles is really not interested in child psychology. Okay, we don't get an account of baby Oedipus, or his growing up, or how he felt about Merope, whom he thought was his mother in Corinth, or how he felt about Polybus, who he thought was his father over there in Corinth, as it were. Sophocles has no interest at that level in child psychology. Okay, so in a way, the play does not invite us to do a kind of standard psychologizing reading of Oedipus exactly in the way that we might be familiar with, or the way in which some commentators might have tried to do or complained about the absence of. But there is a very, very powerful image in the play of the infant, newborn Oedipus and what happens to him or what is done to him. Okay. And it's produced, first of all, in a very, very casual way, in that long speech of Jocasta's that I've asked people to sort of focus on as the first of three speeches in the play. And remember, she comes on stage, there's been a huge row between Oedipus and Creon. She's very distressed that they're at loggerheads, and Oedipus is kind of threatening to have him executed. And she tries to sort of calm things down, and he says, he accused me. You know, he wound up, or he used the prophet Tiresias, who then accused me of being the murderer of the previous king Laius, and he's very upset and worried himself about it. And she says, no, he was killed by a band of robbers. You know, at a place where three roads cross. You know, it's got nothing to do with you. Couldn't have been you. It was, you know, the report back of what happened was there was this band of robbers who attacked him in his train, and only one person survived to bring back the story of what happened, and it took place at a place where three roads cross. And of course, Oedipus is kind of stunned by this, and what he's stunned by is that very, very bare but very suggestive description of where it took place, the place where three roads cross. That phrase is repeated a number of times in the play, and it marks out the place in a very specific way. There's a scene, something takes place there at that scene, and he revisits that, and the play revisits what exactly took place at that scene again and again and again. Now remember, initially, he's not thinking about the oracle that he received from Apollo's shrine at Delphos. He's thinking about rather the second message he's got in response to the fever and the plague that struck Thebes, in which he, as a good and conscientious king, is sent to Apollo's oracle to say, what do I do about this? Please give me some help. And the message comes back is the regicide who killed the previous king is living among you, and that is a pollution that is contaminating the whole city and blighting the fertility of its women and of its fields and etc. And so you must seek out this regicide and expose him and punish him if you want to cleanse the city of its pollution, because you are under a curse. And so he thinks of himself as looking for a regicide. You know, he's not thinking about the prophecy that he'd personally received about that made him flee from Corinth and avoid his home city. So she just says, a place where three roads cross, and it really hits him. But the very next sentence, the next line of verse, is she says, and the child that was supposed to, the whole point she's making is that he was killed by a band of robbers. Yet we had this oracle, you know, that was given us by the priests at Delphos, that said that, you know, we would have a son and he would murder his father. Interesting, the incest isn't mentioned by her. It's simply the patricide, the killing of the father figure. But we cast the child out, and his feet were bound together, and he was cast out to die on a mountain. And she just passes on. So this is, it's just casually produced, but it's immediately produced in relationship to and adjacent to her description of the place where three roads cross, and where the group of robbers are supposed to have killed Laius. Okay, so it's quite startling juxtaposition in Jocasta's speech. So the infant's body, the piercing of the feet, the binding of them together, and they're given to a shepherd to cast him out and expose him on a mountain. And this was kind of, in a way, standard practice in the classical world. I mean, I don't think so much maybe the binding of the feet. I think that's very particular to Sophocles' account. But the exposure of children, the exposure of unwanted children, either because they were just too many and the parents couldn't afford to bring them up, or because in some ways they were cursed, or they were under they were felt to be under some sort of divine sentence of some kind. And there were places where you left them, and what very often the hope was that some charitable person would come along and find them and look after them, etc. So child exposure as a practice was, you know, not uncommon in the classical world. The piercing of the feet, I think, is quite specific to Sophocles. Okay, and he uses the word arthra, meaning joints, and where we get our word arthritis from. Okay, and that word is, again, Gould's commentary is absolutely invaluable here. He picks up on, tells the English reader who doesn't have Greek, you know, the points at which this word is repeated in the play. So this is double piercing, the piercing of the arthra of the tooth of the infant's feet, and his abandonment, his rejection, his casting out by his parents. This is then repeated later on in the play, where Oedipus is pursuing his investigation into what happened to Laios, and he wants to find out, was it done by a band of robbers? And we're told there's an old servant, the one survivor, and he's gone off and he's up in the hills somewhere looking after, tending a flock of sheep on Mount Kithaeron. So he's sent for, and I think Jocasta is ahead of Oedipus on this one. She sees what's coming, and she tries to persuade him, look, forget it, just drop it, you know, don't keep asking questions, it doesn't matter. And he just thinks, oh, you're being snobbish, you know, you think I'm going to turn out to have been, you know, not from a princely house, okay. And this is a response to the arrival of the messenger from Corinth to say, your father's dead. And she says, see, you know, oracles, schmoracles, you know, who cares? You know, they often turn out not to be true. You know, don't get hot and bothered about the whole thing. But at a certain point, when he starts saying, oh, well, actually, you don't need to be bothered, because actually you weren't his son. In fact, you were given to me. By a shepherd that I used to sort of spend time with. You know, he came from Thebes and I came from Corinth, and we used to, you know, shepherd our flocks on the same mountains. You know, so don't worry. You know, you're not going to. You know, you didn't kill Polybus, and he wasn't your dad anyway. And Merope isn't your mother. And at that point, Iocasta, I think, knows. Oh my God, she can see what's coming, and she tries to persuade him to drop the whole thing. He won't, and she exits in a state, saying, "This is the last thing I'll say to you, a miserable man. You know, you are cursed by the gods," or whatever. She goes off, and as we later find out, to commit suicide. And he's still persisting, trying to find out what happened. And the messenger says, "Yes, I found you. You know, your feet were pierced and tied together." And again, he says the same word, Arthra. And he says, "That's how you got your name. That's how you got your name. You were named after that." And in the Greek, as I said in the my email to you, Oedipus's name breaks down into two syllables. Oedipus. Now, that first part of his name, he has already invoked and punned on himself when he's having his argument with the prophet Tiresias. And Tiresias is refusing to say anything, and Oedipus is understandably angry. "You mean you know who killed Laius and you won't tell us? How can you betray the city like this?" And he rages at Tiresias. And finally Tiresias says, "Actually, you're the killer," you know, under enormous pressure and anger from Oedipus. And Oedipus dismisses him. He says, "Oh, how could I at all trust or believe in your powers of prophecy? You know, you, after all, you failed to do anything when the Sphinx was here, when the Sphinx was posing her riddle. You couldn't solve it. You, all with your divinations, you're looking at the entrails of birds, and your supposed power of prophecy. You couldn't solve the riddle of the Sphinx and defeat the Sphinx. I did it. Me." And he comes out in with a line of Greek verse, "Ho maiden," I think it's A-N, "Eidos Oedipus," which literally means, "I, nothing knowing, no foot." Okay. So by doubling the word Oedipus with Eidos, meaning no, you know, "I who know nothing, ignorant old me," you know, and it's obviously he's being ironic here. "I solve the problem with my intelligence, with my nomos, the use of my human faculty, with your use of your supposedly divine powers, divinely given powers of prophecy. You couldn't do it. I did it with using my nous, my intelligence, my shrewdness. Me, nothing knowing, no foot." And of course, in punning on, actually he plays on both halves of his name, oide meaning from the verb to know, and pus meaning foot. Okay, and of course the feet was what the riddle was about. The Sphinx, it was posing this enigma to and to whoever tried to come in or out of the city, and if they couldn't answer the riddle, she killed them. And the riddle was, what is that creature which walks in the morning on 4 feet, at noonday walks on 2 feet, and in the evening walks on 3 feet, and is feeblest when it walks on most feet? Is at its weakest when it walks on 4 feet, or on most feet? And what rhymes there again and again is tetrapus, meaning 4 foot, dipus, meaning 2 foot, tripus, meaning 3 foot, Oedipus. And so Oedipus is alluding to the riddle that he solved, okay, by saying, calling himself in effect no foot, the one who knew about feet, okay. And it's I think presented by Sophocles and traditionally, and I think quite plausibly interpreted as an act of hubris and of an assertion of a kind of like a humanist rationality. That is meant to, by Sophocles, to in some ways represent the whole culture of the Athenian Enlightenment, which was, and particularly the whole tradition of philosophy, which was calling into question and interrogating critically the myths of the gods, about the gods, and claiming powers and privileges for the use of human reason. So, and I think it was Hegel called Oedipus the first philosopher, and in that tradition of German continental philosophy, Oedipus is seen as a kind of allegorical representative of the use of philosophical reason. So a moment of pride on Oedipus's part. Little old me, little old know nothing, no foot. I solved the riddle. You were hopeless. So he's dismissing Tiresias and his divinely sanctioned insight or knowledge, as it were. But of course, that, if we hadn't already picked it up, and of course you have to remember that this is not a whodunit. The Greek audience knew the story. They all knew what was to come. And so what they're listening for is how that fate is to kind of be played out on the tragic stage. So they can hear and perhaps anticipate the pun which is not that on knowledge, okay, but it's a pun on another Greek verb. I think it's spelt with a double E, to swell. And that's what the messenger does. The messenger comes and turns around the meaning of Oedipus's name by saying, that's why you were called, that's why you were given your name. That names you who you are, he says. Oidain, swell foot, or swollen, the swollen-footed one. Okay. And indeed, Greek commentators have often said that the whole family line of which Laius and goes back to an ancestor called Labdacus, who was a limping figure. So limping and swollen-footed and people who are maimed at the foot, there is this ancestral connection there, which again a Greek audience would have been aware of. So he thinks of himself as no foot, and what the messenger of Corinth says, you're actually swell-foot. But don't worry, your father's dead, so you're not going to commit patricide, and you needn't be worried anyway because he wasn't really your father. But he deposits this bombshell, okay, that the maiming of the infant's feet has given him his name and in a sense his identity. He is named. That names you who you are. The Corinthian messenger says. So we have this sense of this Oedipus's body as being on the receiving end of a kind of violence that has come from the outside, whether it's the infant Oedipus, whether it's different moments, this act of violence is repeated in different contexts. His encounter with this old man in a chariot who tries to push him out of the way at the place where three roads cross, or again, what he then does in full knowledge and full consciousness to himself when he's discovered who and what he is, okay, where he puts out his eyes. Again, very usefully, Gould comments on the fact that Sophocles uses the same word, arthra, in a very unique way in Greek, to refer not to the joints of the feet, but to the eyes, the arthra of his eyes, and people puzzle over it. Could this be, a scribal error or something? But as he says, this double blinding relates back to a series of double acts of violence done to Oedipus's body in the course of the play, or in the course of his life, which is relived in the play. So a kind of violent marking, a traumatic wounding, double wounding of the tragic protagonist's body is something that the play keeps focusing us on. Now, I want to say something at this point about Freud's reading of the tragedy, and the moment in the development of his thought where he turns to Sophocles and Shakespeare's Hamlet, and he thinks of them together. They're twinned in his mind. Hamlet and Oedipus, and in all the excerpts I've given you, he no sooner mentions Oedipus than Hamlet will come up as well, and he sketches out a kind of a reading of both plays in the letter to Fleece, and then he elaborates that and rewrites that in that section from chapter 5, I think it is, on typical dreams. From the interpretation of dreams, where he gives him a fuller account. He's not writing a literary critical essay. He's thinking about two tragedies in order, in some ways, to help himself think through a moment of theoretical crisis or blockage in his own thought. And where he first does this, or where we have a first evidence of it, is within 3 weeks. It is the letter to Fleece about Oedipus and Hamlet is in October the 15th, I think, 1897, 3 weeks after a previous letter, which we also looked at, where he says, I don't think I believe my theory of traumatic seduction anymore because there are all these problems that it, you know, that I can't solve in relation to the theory. So in the wake of his, and it is only a temporary one because he oscillates back and forwards, but in the wake of his first and partial or temporary abandonment, rather, of his theory of traumatic seduction, he turns to these two plays, and he becomes really intensely preoccupied with these two tragedies. And he's clearly thinking, you could say partly thinking outside the box, or trying to think outside the framework of his theory, using literature to do that. And he does that on a number of occasions, in which, in a moment of theoretical crisis, he turns to aesthetic questions, or to a literary texts that preoccupy him, as it were. We'll see another example of this next term, towards the end of next term in 1919, where Freud is reformulating his drive theory and bringing on stage for the first time the notion of the death drive. And he takes time off to write an essay on the uncanny, and the aesthetics of the uncanny, and he produces a reading of a great 19th century German romantic writer, E.T.A. Hoffmann, a reading of his novella, The Sandman. We've already looked at one of Hoffmann's novellas, but Freud gives a kind of a reading of that. And it's a fascinating sort of double moment, 1897, 1919, where at moments of theoretical crisis, Freud turns to literature and starts thinking about literature as a way, partly as a way through the crisis. He does something similar with a text we'll be looking at next term, in relation to the question of seduction, where he writes his fascinating case study of Leonardo da Vinci, and he does a reading of some of Leonardo's paintings, and we'll be looking at that next term as well. So certain moments, art or literature become crucial in Freud's thinking. It's as if it becomes internal to the development of his theory. Now, in both the case of the two tragedies that we're looking at this week and next week, and of Hoffman's text we'll be looking at next term, Freud chooses texts, or he seems drawn to, magnetized by texts that have a traumatic structure to them, which seem to be organized around sort of a process of traumatic repetition, in which a scene of trauma is reframed, resignified, translated, if you like, in a kind of almost compulsive way. He's drawn to texts that have that traumatic structure, and he then gives an Oedipal reading of them, okay, both of the two tragedies and of Hoffmann's novella. Now, I want to situate the readings he gives of the tragedies in relation to this first turning point in his thought, and in particular to the way in which Laplanche had both redescribed it and criticized it, that is to say, in terms of Laplanche's distinction, or actually Freud's distinction, which Laplanche takes up, between the Copernican and the Ptolemaic, between a conceptual model that is centered on the other, just as in cosmology, the Earth isn't the center around which the universe moves, but is itself merely a dependent planet that circles around the sun in a localized solar system, and a Ptolemaic model, which had dominated both European and Middle Eastern culture for hundreds and hundreds of years, where the Earth is at the center of the universe and everything else moves around the Earth. And Freud had set up himself and psychoanalysis in relationship to what he sees as the three blows to human narcissism and self-centering that science had given challenged human narcissism. Now, Laplanche takes that up and kind of partly twists it around and reapplies it back to Freud, as we saw. And he makes the very, I think, telling suggestion that if Freud is his own Copernicus, he is also his own Ptolemy. In other words, within the field of psychoanalysis, these two contradictory logics of decentering and recentering play themselves out in different texts, sometimes even in the same text of Freud's. Now, this is the moment where Freud moves from his model of traumatic seduction to the beginnings. It's just the seed, the beginnings of his developmentalist model of sexuality in general. And he says, in a suggestive phrase to Fleece in the letter, he wants to posit a universal event in childhood, the falling in love with the mother, the rivalry with the father, that configuration, which he finds in his, again and again, in his clinical material and in his own personal self-analysis. And he wants to think about that, and he immediately moves on to thinking about that's why we find Oedipus Rex so compelling a tragedy. And then he goes on to think about Hamlet as well, the puzzle of Hamlet and Hamlet's paralysis and Hamlet's delay. So his interpretation of the tragedies replicates that logic of recentering that is in the process of taking place in his theory. And he says of the tragedy, he says, it's often thought of as a tragedy of fate, and that's the form it's taken, where the action of the gods determines the protagonist's destiny, he says, but that's not why it's so powerful. That's not why it continues to haunt modern people who don't believe in the gods, okay? And attempts to imitate Greek tragedy just haven't worked. He says, what gives it its power is not its the role of the gods and of the oracle and the divine or demonic determination of human life, but the material in which it's played out, the material of patricide and incest. Because everybody in the audience was once a budding Oedipus, and this play awakens all that material again, and we find it kind of disturbing or compelling or whatever. And he simply sees the role of the oracle and of Apollo as being, he says, the externalization of an inner necessity. Okay, it's simply a way of projecting outwards what is this inner compulsion, which impulses that are imposed on us by nature, he says, which are unavoidable and universal. So the external agencies in the play are simply projections outwards of these inner Oedipus's inner impulses. And it's Oedipus's inner impulses drive the action or drive the play. And a standard objection people have made to Freud's reading is, well hang on a minute, Oedipus is given this warning by the oracle, and he does his best to avoid it. You know, instead of he comes from Corinth to Delphos to say, somebody told me that I'm not really the child of my parents. Please, Apollo, will you confirm or not this story? And he says, Apollo dishonored me. He didn't tell me. He didn't answer my question. But he gave me something else instead. He gave me this appalling prophecy that I was fated to kill my father and marry my mother. And so he avoids Corinth. He immediately sort of heads in the opposite direction. And what is he? The first thing that happens to him is he encounters this man in a chariot at a place where three roads cross, who tries to push him out of the way and who strikes him down, and he strikes back and kills the man. So in rebound from the prophecy, doing his best to avoid it, he ends up enacting it, okay? And if you think about the parents as well, the same thing has happened with them, right? They got this terrible prophecy, and the first thing they did as soon as the child was born, it was a boy, they pierced its feet and cast it out in an attempt to avoid these sacrilegious and polluting acts that would have been the consequences of the child growing up, etc. And it's that very act that, as it were, makes Oedipus ignorant of who his parents are. And so people say, well, hang on, he couldn't have been acting on his Oedipus complex, his so-called Oedipus complex, in that case. Okay. And Freud's response is to say, Oedipus's ignorance of what he's done and who he is simply the representation of the unconscious nature of these impulses. Okay. Oedipus's ignorance of what he's done and who his parents are is a representation of the unconscious nature of these impulses. So what Freud has done, in effect, at the level of his interpretation of Greek and also Shakespearean tragedy, is to center the tragic protagonist on his own impulses. It's the impulses of Oedipus, which have been acted out, or in Hamlet's case, haven't been acted out, but have been repressed, that drive and therefore explain the tragic action. And the rest is just, you know, a sort of allegorization or projection of those inner impulses. So in effect, he's collapsed an external agency into Oedipus's own inner impulses. He's, in a sense, made a Ptolemaic interpretation, to use those two terms, a Ptolemaic interpretation which excludes or forecloses or marginalizes the relationship to the other. And the other, in this case, is figured by this repeated word in the play that Gould draws our attention to, the daemon. At key moments when Oedipus does things, we're told, you know, a daemon lunged or a daemon showed the way. Okay, so Oedipus does things, they're his actions, but in acting, in performing those actions, some other force is at work, okay? A force that comes to him from the outside and from the other. So that Freud's reading, while it acknowledges and sees a pattern in both plays, makes sense of it by centering it back on the tragic protagonist, instead of seeing how the tragic protagonist is himself decentered by his relationship to these daemonic, or in Hamlet's case, spectral figures, ghostly figure of the father, that hound him down or that haunt him in various ways in the two tragedies. Using Le Planche's 180-degree spin on the Copernican Ptolemaic terminology, it would raise the question, which at a theoretical level, Laplanche's work always raises, is where is the other in this? Okay, how do these concepts of repression, sublimation, ego formation, the drive, how are they related to the intervention of the other? Position them in relation to the other. In other words, he insists on the Copernican dimension at the level of theory, and I think it gives us a prompt to ask the Copernican question in relationship to the interpretation of these two tragedies. Okay, Freud points to a triangular pattern and centers it on the tragic protagonist, but we need to think about how is the tragic protagonist decentered, okay, in the process of the action of the two tragedies. Okay, so it's in a way it's the Copernican question at the level of literary interpretation. So Le Planche's theoretical development, I think, helps us to try and recapture a certain dimension of the two tragedies that Freud's reading tends to sideline or to marginalize. Okay, let's stop there for the time being.